For North Americans, I have the impression that as a general introduction to liberation theology, this is a good book. Philip Berryman, Liberation Theology. He spent a number of years in Central America, in Panama, if I'm not mistaken, and does know very well the theological and church situation in Latin America. I think it's a good introduction, also with the kinds of questions that North Americans have towards liberation theology. Also relating in one chapter with feminism and black theology, establishing a little bit of a dialogue between these currents. So before I forget to make the suggestions again, and this is the last session of our week on liberation theology. Next week I will be teaching on church-state as a general theme. So I think we could get started for the tape purposes. I'm Walter Altman, and today's session is on Jesus Christ, Good News for the Poor, the closing session on our series in introducing liberation theology. Jesus Christ, Good News, that is, I think, known and accepted everywhere by Christians, at least. But Good News for the Poor seems to be a sort of limitation, and then possibly the question arises already, is that legitimate or not? So I chose somewhat of a provoking title already when saying Jesus Christ, Good News for the Poor. But it does give the main stress of what liberation theology is being saying about Jesus Christ. How did we get to that point, and how should we understand that? I could remind that episode of the disciples with Jesus, narrated in Matthew 16. You all know it, where Jesus asks, who do the people say that I am? And, well, they give several answers, a prophet, Elias, and then he asks, well, do you say that I am? This is a very fundamental question. So, well, do you say that I am? So we could say it's a kind of, Latin America is trying to give a response to the question that Jesus raises to Latin Americans, who do you say that I am? Well, we know from that episode of Matthew 16 that Peter gave the answer, you are the Christ, and that Jesus answered, that answer was revealed. You are the Christ, the Messiah. So that was the correct answer in the formulation. But it is very evident that Jesus was asking a little bit more than just the correct formulation of the answer, who he is. Because Jesus continues saying, well, I have to suffer and die on the cross. And then Peter, the same Peter who gave that doctrinally correct answer, the same Peter, answers, no, not at all, that won't happen. And Jesus rebukes, well, that comes from Satan. So inspired by the Spirit, moved by Satan, that was side by side with Peter. And the answer was not a simple correct answer on the doctrinal level, but the answer was supposed to be a living answer. And confessing Christ is always a living confession, and not only a spoken confession. So if we take up that kind of question to Latin Americans, Latin American Christians living in that continent, it is a question, therefore, not only for the right, proper answer in words, but it is the answer given with the life of the Christians themselves. What is the answer? And along this framework, we'll get to the kind of statement, Jesus Christ, good news for the poor. Well, let me recall a little bit of Latin American history in what it applies to how Jesus was perceived in Latin America. And I might perhaps even add that we not only say words about Jesus Christ, and we don't only live out our faith in Jesus Christ, but we also have images of who Jesus Christ is. The Bible itself, the New Testament, is full of images and pictures for Jesus and for the church. So there are images which are associated in a given situation to Jesus or the Christ. And in Latin American history, throughout that history, we can detect two main images. There are more, of course, but two have become especially important throughout the history. One of the images is of the dead Jesus. Dead, suffering, impotent Jesus who dies on the cross. That is one image, and I will talk a little bit more about that. The other image is of a heavenly monarch, Jesus in heaven, after resurrection. These two images have been very important in Latin America. How? Well, I think I mentioned already in one of the previous sessions, and some of you who have been in Latin America might have experienced that when going into one of the big cathedrals or larger churches, Catholic churches in Latin America, you might find a crypt beneath the main altar, and quite often you will find behind glasses in another altar, you will see the body of Jesus, a sculpture of course, the body of Jesus lying, dead, suffering, bleeding. And you look at that sculpture, that figure, you see that this Jesus suffered immensely and that he cannot do anything about it. He's a defeated one. He's impotent. It was an absolute suffering. And then you see masses of people in Latin America who around that image, the different stations of the way of the cross, they will meditate upon the suffering of Jesus. What happens at that moment? Why is that kind of image so significant for Latin Americans? Well, the roots go back even to Spain and Portugal before the so-called discovery of the Americas. When Spain and Portugal, the Iberic Peninsula, was occupied by Arabs, by non-Christians. So the experience of about 8 centuries in the Iberic Peninsula was an experience of suffering by Christians. So the image of the Jesus who died on the cross and could not do anything about it was very strong in the mystic in the Iberic Peninsula already. And that kind of mystic was taken to Latin America too. And then in Latin America, throughout the history, particular history of Latin America, that became more and more the image with which the poor people, and that's the majority of Latin America, could identify. And also the masses of Indian populations, blacks when they became Christians, enslaved blacks, all those who suffered under injustices, under poverty, these life conditions, they would come to that Jesus, see the Jesus dead, and say, That's us. That's what we are going through too. And there was a profound sense of identification with that Jesus. And at the same time, the impotence of that Jesus was also the impotence of these peoples. What perspective do we have of coming out of the situation of suffering? And no way was seen, and a certain fatalism started to build up. That's the situation in which we were born, that's the situation we are going through. Just like Jesus was impotent, that's our fate. Well, that was one of the images. The other one, of the heavenly king, the heavenly monarch. There are paintings or sculptures where you can see the Jesus Christ in heaven sitting on a throne, just like the throne of the king of Spain or Portugal. He was dressed with luxurious vestments. They looked just like the ones the king of Spain or the king of Portugal had. He had a crown, not the crown of thorns of the Jesus on the cross, but a crown just like the crown of the king of Spain, crown of gold, gold taken away from the Indians in the Americas. That was the heavenly king. That was the powerful one. But he was in heaven. Who looked like the heavenly Christ here on earth? Well, the king of Spain, the king of Portugal. Therefore, he was for sure the best representative that the heavenly monarch had here on her earth. So the poor peoples, they could not identify with that heavenly monarch. He was not one of them. He was completely different. He was just like the king of Spain and Portugal. And that was where his power was. The one who died on the cross, he was impotent. So there were two images in a very great tension with each other. Doctrinally, of course, there was a certain knowledge that somehow that was the same Jesus Christ, but how would it be the same? The emotional perception, the devotional perception of the people was split. Majority of the population suffering with the one suffering Jesus, dead Jesus. And on the other hand, the powers of the heavenly monarch given to the king of Spain and Portugal and their representatives. So that kind of dichotomy was behind much of the history of Latin America. I spoke on Monday more on the kind of alliance between the process of conquest of that continent and the legitimacy that was given by the Christian faith in one joint project of Christianizing new lands and new peoples and so on. And so the powerful one was coming with a king and the functionaries of the crown, the expeditions and the missionaries paid by the crown of Spain and Portugal, and on the other hand the peoples being evangelized along the process, becoming Christians when they were Indian populations or black populations becoming Christians, relating only with a dead Jesus, but then an impotent one, and adopting a sort of fatalism. Well, how to overcome such a dichotomy, such a separation of two Jesus, different ones, one functioning for a part of the poor people and the other one being a legitimation for the powerful ones. How to overcome that? In such a situation, could we expect realistically that there would be a kind of a movement of theology of liberation, liberation in the name of Christ, liberation coming from Christ. Wouldn't we have to expect much more a liberation against Jesus Christ due to this whole history? Wouldn't that be much more natural, logic, reasonable to expect? What happened that there is that sort of a wonder that suddenly there is a broad movement-based communities who draw their hopes and their expectations and their strength for struggle from this Jesus Christ? Well, probably a number of things happened, but I think what happened most fundamentally is that with the process of developing of base communities, of which we spoke the other evening, and the centrality of the Bible in that process, people started rediscovering a different Jesus. Not totally different, of course, there were things in the two images which resembled somehow our tradition, but they were separated from different people and so on. But now rereading the scripture out of the situation in which these base communities are, suddenly they are listening to new features. And especially then in the Synoptic Gospels. Synoptic Gospels have become very important at the early stage of the movement of base communities. So they might discover Luke 4, right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, saying that he came to liberate the poor. Well, that's suddenly a new tone, something new was being heard. Or they might read the Beatitudes, "Blessed are you, the poor." And so, and when they look what Jesus did, healing the sick, being alongside with all those who were marginalized, women, children, the poor, the sick, I mentioned. So there is a certain trend which is being perceived, and which is then called later on in the theology the preference. God has a preference. God is looking for who is in need. Right at the end of the ministry, Jesus speaks of that parable, Matthew 25, 31 to 46, of what you have done to one of the least ones. Well, so many least ones in that continent were hungry, thirsty, don't have to where to go, no shelter, are in prison, don't have clothing. So on these are the least ones. You will be judged according to whatever you have done or not done to one of the least ones. So there's a different preference. And suddenly, these poor people organized in base communities, reading scripture and so on, realize not only that Jesus who died on the cross is on our side, we can identify with the Jesus who died, but there is an active solidarity of Jesus with us. Wherever we are and whatever we are suffering, He is on our side, He is coming along our ways. That kind of solidarity gives a different sense of identification. So now they feel not we are suffering just what this dead Jesus suffered, but Jesus is coming to us, is on our side, is actively engaged, and we read it in the scriptures, He is helping us, He is healing us. That is the beginning of a fundamental change in perceiving who is Jesus? That was our starting question. Who do you say that I am? Jesus is one who identified himself with all those who are in need and who suffer, and did so actively. And then, let me try to move a little bit quicker. A new understanding of Jesus' death arises too. Because suddenly Jesus' death is seen as a culmination, as a high point of that journey of Jesus. When I did my theological studies at seminary, there was a very strong influence by Protestant theology, coming from Germany especially, kind of saying, well, everything is concentrated in the cross. And some theologians might even say, well, all the rest, life of Jesus before that, that's a kind of unimportant introduction to what is then really important, which is Jesus' death. The new knowledge, new rereading of scripture that comes out of the base communities, so that can't be. Otherwise, why are these pages right there? The one who died is the one who did all these things. That led towards the point where he was persecuted and then killed. And the death of Jesus Christ is not something unexplainable that we cannot understand. Such a good person, he was killed. How could that happen? If it would be in our days, it certainly would not happen. But the death of Jesus is to be understood in the light of the life that Jesus had, and of what he did, how he acted, how he confronted the religious and political authorities of that time. Possibly not in the way in which some groups expected. He was not a zealot, for example, one of those who tried to fight militarily Roman presence in Palestine, but nevertheless, with all what Jesus did, and fundamentally with the fact that he was on the side of those who were marginalized, those who were in need, those who were suffering, that was his preferential place. And whenever he spoke to those who were not in need, he established relations out of which Zacchaeus, for example, suddenly discovers, yes, Jesus is also on my side, but I have to change my life. So even when going to the others, Jesus continued to be on the side of the poor and of those who suffered. And that was challenging. That brought about the forces that wanted to bring down that kind of movement, which was built upon the solidarity, the intense love with those who suffer. And therefore Jesus was not acceptable. He was breaking the religious rules, he was being a challenge to the political powers. And at that particular moment, there was also a close connection between religious and political authorities, and Jesus died. So nothing unexplainable, which you just now in a devotion have to suffer with Jesus, but at the same time knowing that is the point where it led. But then also the next point, who resurrected? The one who resurrected is also the same one, and is not a different one, who is now in heaven powerfully, but without any concrete relation to the one who died, and kind of delegating his authority and power to those who are powerful here on earth. But the one who resurrected started to come again alongside with his disciples, and when he left, sent his Spirit, but to continue on the same line, on the same active participation in human history, on the side of poor. So the one who resurrected is not a different one, is the one who acted that way, and it's the same one who then was killed, he resurrected. That brings about hope. So suddenly those poor masses of people in Latin America can identify with the suffering, and or they do it the reverse. They see that Jesus came to us on our side and suffered. That's our fate, but that's not a fate without perspective, without hope. But that's the one who also resurrected, and therefore we also are moving towards resurrection. So the dichotomy, that separation of the dead Jesus and the heavenly King is overcome, and that's the same one. It's one journey, one history. And in that context, again, what becomes important, Jesus is calling, follow me. Take upon yourselves my cross. The concept of following Jesus becomes the discipleship, following Jesus, a parallel to a good extent between Bonhoeffer's theology and liberation theology, the concept of the following of Jesus. So what is happening in the life of Christians should be, can be, what is happening in the following of Jesus. And that gives an enormous strength to people involved in base communities, to many of the people living in oppressive situations. In the meantime, in Latin America, in this movement of base communities and their active participation in society, and then also confronting the powers who then blame it to be subversive, just as they blamed Jesus, could not accept, he is disrupting our laws. Jesus was accused of that. His healing on the Sabbath, that was a basic law of the society at that time. So Jesus was accused of being, of breaking laws, being subversive. So these things happen, and people are put into prison because of their following of Jesus, or even dying, as quite a few, several thousands of Christians in Latin America and several countries have been killed because of that type of commitment. These people are celebrated in the base communities as new martyrs. They are remembered in the worship of the base communities. That is the way of following Jesus actively in solidarity with those who suffer. But this is now a suffering that is taken, but as a consequence of an active engagement. It's not anymore that suffering which was simply inflicted and under which people were suffering without any perspective of hope, without any reasonable explanation, just accepting it as a fate. But this new suffering is of a different sort. It's the suffering in the following of Jesus. It comes after the suffering of Jesus, which was fundamental, the first one. He suffered alone. All those who suffer today suffer in the following of Jesus and are not alone, therefore. And it's not without perspective. It's done in the light of the resurrection. It's moving forward. And that brings the dynamics of liberation. And Jesus Christ, the new image now, is being perceived as Jesus Christ, the liberator. Not the one who consolidates suffering, and you then identify with it. But the one who is moving and others are following, that's the Jesus. And that's good news. That's good news then for the poor. It can be good news also for the non-poor, but it will be good news for the non-poor from the side of the poor. From there is the call, a call of join in this journey of following Jesus. Take upon yourself my cross, says that Jesus. That's the kind of answer that Jesus suggesting when he asks the question which he asked the disciples, who do you say that I am? Well, okay, thank you. Let's open our dialogue, questions, comments.
Yes. One thought that that kind of bothers me is the some of the stuff you wrapped up with, that Jesus Christ can be good news for the non-poor, but in terms of the poor. And does that mean that we, the non-poor, will never be as joyful in Christ as the poor? Are we the disadvantaged in that sense? Or are there ways that we can reach full glory and joy in Jesus Christ?
Well, you ask whether we are disadvantaged. I think we have, and I belong to your category in that sense. I'm not a poor myself in Brazil. We have a good number of advantages already. So when liberation theology says there is a preference, God's preference of the poor, is just saying that God is in favor of equality, that all human beings are equal for God. But because they are so much in disadvantage, God and Jesus is now in the first place on their side. Then the second part of your question, I think, was, well, can that be a joyful message for us? Well, it can be a joyful message, but it's not an easy joy. It's not something that we can take for granted, something that which will just confirm us in our advantages, which we have in relation to them. But it's a call to be equal, to recognize that, as God will, to be equal with them. And if we then move towards the poor, also in a movement of solidarity and identification, of course, never anything comparable to that kind of solidarity and identification that Jesus had and has with them, but nevertheless a movement towards them, that would be joyful in itself, to experience that we can live as brothers and sisters, that we are children of God with them, that we can be side by side with them. That brings about a joy. The message brings discomfort in some areas which are probably somehow enslaving us. We might be caught up in our advantages and in our affluence and so on, and are in a kind of a prison of that, having to reproduce that, always being in a compulsion of reproducing it, even if it affects the life of the poor. And then we might perhaps continue that type of life, and but feel guilty and we have no joy and so on. So the joy comes in the sense in which we can find that we are equals and that God does not take for granted the disadvantages that they are under. I think many people who, even I've, many North Americans who have spent time in Latin America, shorter periods, longer periods, and so on, in contact with base communities, they almost unanimously say, well, we experience such, suddenly we experience there such freedom, such joy, and so on, that was a liberating experience for ourselves in sharing whatever they have as fate, as their life, and that happens.
For those of us who don't travel but remain in North America, but we recognize that there are many Latin American people moving to North America, can you give some suggestions or insights on how Roman Catholic and Protestant churches might use liberation theology, be enriched by it, as we reach out to Latin Americans who are becoming North Americans?
Well, I think you bring about a good example. You are being exposed, let's say, so more and more to the presence of Latins in your own country, in increasing numbers, and many of them, or most of them, are poor, are coming because of political, of economic reasons to the United States, trying to have a better living here, and so on. And I think it is very important for the churches to establish bridges of communication, of establishing links of brotherhood and sisterhood with those who are coming, and they themselves probably very often don't understand themselves as ambassadors of Latin American based communities or so. Perhaps even rather the contrary, they are looking for a job in which they get so many dollars, which in their own currency would be very much money, and have better days here, so they have a sort of a dream. So their dream is kind of getting upwards, is not the dream of solidarity with the poor quite often. Nevertheless, I think it's very important to establish links. How to do it exactly, I don't know. I think wherever there are Hispanics, I think it's a question for the existing non-Latin congregation. What does that mean for us? I live in St. Paul at the missionary apartments this year. I spent there and so got in contact with quite a few North American missionaries in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, came for furlough or so to the United States, and some of them coming back to the United States now accepting a call. And one of them coming back from Argentina, he received a call to a congregation in Miami, and he was first moment very much pleased because there was the English speaking congregation and there was the Spanish, also a Spanish congregation. And after he received the call and had almost accepted it, because he had also an invitation from somewhere else, but he was attracted to that, he heard that they got separated because there was so much conflict between the two the two congregations, he didn't know exactly what had happened, what was going on and so on, but somehow as a symbol it was significant for me too. Probably there was a certain moment where it was established very consciously, a missionary work, a ministry to Hispanics, and out of that came also a Spanish-speaking congregation. The same church had first English-speaking, English service, then Spanish service, and so on, and suddenly they decide to separate. That's a kind of a very strange and sad sign. So can we understand the other culture? Are we open towards the others? To be open towards the stranger? Do we expect the stranger who is coming to this country just to adjust himself or herself to the existing situation? Why did he or she come here after all? Now, better do as it is proper here or so. Or is there a willingness of Christians to be engaged in a movement of identification with them and their feelings, their faith? Or is it just the expectation that it goes the other way around? That might be one important question, as much as I felt the situation. I imagine that doesn't help too much in a concrete way, but if every congregation where there are Hispanics would kind of ask that kind of question, how do we relate to them here in place, probably very creative steps would be taken here and there. Yes. Oh, over there.
You characterized how Jesus was viewed in the traditional Latin American culture, and then how the dichotomy has been put together in the liberation theology. From your staying here for a year in North America, how would you characterize North Americans answering the question, who is Jesus? And what images do you pick up that we see in Jesus? The reason I'm asking that is I find it helpful to compare, particularly from somebody who's coming from a different culture, what you see is how we see Jesus in comparison to how people in liberation theology are seeing Jesus.
Well, I will say something to that, how I have perceived image of Christ in North America, but please accept that as just one impression, not as a kind of a definite word that I would have on that, because it's too short of a time really to grasp that, so I might very well be doing injustice. But, well, I did not find that kind of separation, well, a dead Jesus impotent and a heavenly king. So that's not the case. I think, in general, the image is somehow connected, the Jesus on the cross and the resurrected Jesus. For most North Americans, I have felt they are pretty close. There is an awareness that's the same one. What I do think is very often a different sort of separation, that this Jesus who died and resurrected is somewhat unreal, in the sense that he is not just like us. Really, it's kind of sweet, doesn't challenge too much. What Jesus did in his life is spiritualized, the healings and so on, and the message is spiritualized. When you get to a text like the rich young man coming to Jesus, what shall I do? And Jesus finally said, well, sell everything you have, and then finally the kind of the interpretation that I've heard a couple of times is, well, not the wealth in itself was the problem, but hanging on it, kind of implying that, well, if I don't hang on it, I can keep it. And so, and I kept wondering sometimes how you can keep something without hanging on it. but that kind of separation of everyday life, where is Jesus? Where can we depict him? Where would he be? And so on. We kind of assume that he is in words, our preaching, there he is, and that's correct. But if you look back, just to understand why I'm suggesting this now, is if you take the types of images that were in Latin America, and the whole history of Latin American suffering and killing of people and so on, and in the name of Jesus, our God, very often and so on, you would not solve that problem just coming to the right words and the correct preaching of Jesus if it were not a living process, something within reality where people could say, oh, yes, that's Jesus. And so I have sometimes a little bit of impression the process of spiritualization of not only the biblical message but of Jesus itself is of Jesus himself, that's something I felt. Whether that's really correct or not, I leave it for your own consideration or even reaction. I would actually appreciate feedback on that, since you asked me and I was so frank to give my impression.
Traveling in Mexico, we spent Easter week, and we found that Good Friday was the last big celebration. It was just like Jesus had never resurrected. Did you find this true? Or is liberation theology more the other way, that he has resurrected?
Yes. Well, you came across to a part of traditional Latin American celebration where kind of culminates with Jesus' death. Mm-hmm. And I think rightly so, you asked yourself, and what about resurrection? The base communities I mentioned the other evening, I might repeat it, the base communities have now changed the traditional devotion of the way of the cross, the 14 stations, which would end with a dying of Jesus, with the death of Jesus, then adding a 15th station, which is the resurrection. So all the process of the way of the cross ends then with a meditation and prayer, and so concentrated on the resurrection. That gives a completely different
perspective. Is that exclusive with the base communities, or is that with all the churches?
Well, the Protestant churches, the Protestant churches, of course, had a somewhat different history. Mm-hmm. Being minority churches, they are, of course, under the influence of these big traditions in Latin America to some extent. But already in the 30s, so much before liberation theology was, John McKay, missionary in Latin America, Protestant missionary in Latin America, wrote a book, a very, very good book and far-seeing book, The Other Spanish Christ is the title of the book, The Other Spanish Christ. And one point he precisely makes is that Latin American spirituality has to come more to the reality of the resurrection of Christ. Was one of the insights he had at that time. And liberation theology at the very beginning was very much resurrection, then almost going to the other extreme, neglecting suffering. I mentioned that the other evening too, and I think only now is a kind of approach which tries to see the whole process in totality, Jesus' life, dying, and resurrection, and what does that mean for us. So Protestant churches, they had usually a stronger emphasis already previous years on the resurrection of Christ, but they also suffered in Latin America to a good extent under that tendency of spiritualizing and not applying to the concrete reality of the people. That is also a problem down there.
It's so opposed with the American church that it left us feeling rather empty, like Christ had never risen. Mm-hmm. We also found, and I wanted to ask you this, is we found through Central America that Jesus was always depicted as a white, fair-haired Caucasian. Is that true in knowing Brazil is about 80% black, isn't it?
No, it's not that much. Brazil at the time of independence had about 2/3 of the population were blacks. Then came the movement of European immigration, very strong, Germans, Italians, and later Japanese and many other nationalities. So the proportion of white population increased very much. It's difficult in Brazil to have exact statistics because there has been so much interracial mixture and there are no clear boundaries between races. We don't. That's different way of perceiving races from the one you have in your country. You get forms you have to mark whether black, Hispanic, white, or what. So it's a little bit difficult, but most sociologists estimate that that probably 40-45% still would be considered blacks.
How do they depict Jesus on the cross?
Well, for the blacks, of course, there was also, in the sense that they became Christians forcefully very often. And very often, blacks, when they were caught in Africa, before they were put into the ships to be brought to the Americas, they were baptized right there by force, so that if they would die as a third to a half of them would die along the journey, they would not die as heathens. So right there already they became Christians, and they were obliged to participate then in the church life in the colonial times in Brazil, and since all other family tribal linkage were disrupted and they families were broken, one member of the family sent to one place, the other one to the other, and alongside would be another black slave from another tribe. They could not even communicate, they had originally different languages, so they had to adopt the Portuguese language, and so also religion they had to adopt and became Christians. And in that process, of course, because they were suffering also, there is that process of identification with a dead Jesus. But at the same time, there was also a strong movement, which is still very strong today, of a certain syncretism of African beliefs, traditions, with Catholic Christian elements. So you can find among black populations mainly, but in the meantime also among non-blacks, sort of syncretistic religion in Brazil called Umbanda, which, for example, will identify the Catholic saints with the African traditional spirits and would maintain traditional Catholic cults and worship, but at the same time adopt Christian elements. And Jesus can perhaps be considered the higher spirit, not the one, the greatest God, not, but among the spirits which are kind of in between God and us, Jesus could be considered the most important one. That is one element of devotion and piety which can be found in among blacks in Brazil.
I think he was asking how they portrayed him as the blue eyed.
Oh, okay, okay.
If their Jesus looks like them, or if he's still
well
the Europeans' Jesus.
Well, there are in Latin America quite a few Jesus who look Indian, or the Virgin Mary would look Indian, and the same also in Brazil. In some areas, you can find also rather black or mestizo images. So Jesus would not be portrayed immediately as white, and not blonde anyhow, perhaps more Spanish.
It just distresses me to see a picture of Jesus in Central America who is fair and blue eyed, because I know Jesus was not fair and blue eyed.
No. He
was bald.
That image comes out of another context, of course. Yes, please.
I just wanted to ask you, I had the opportunity to hear a Russian Baptist minister speak several years ago, and after his talk, a question was asked to him by one of the people in the audience. They asked him, what did he see as being the biggest difference between the churches in the United States and his churches in Russia? And he said that he felt that people here, Christian people here, don't know the value of suffering. That was his response. And I just wondered what you thought of that, and if you could comment on that, if you would share with us some of your own feelings about the value of suffering.
Yeah. Well, I've heard quite a bit about suffering in the United States and preaching in churches. So I'm not totally sure that this is a really neglected item. I think some memory of this basic tradition coming out of the New Testament is present, but very often, of course, when I listen to suffering, usually I, already coming from my context, I associate it with people starving, history of enslavement, landless people not having how to make a living, unemployed people without any income because there is no social security for unemployed, or with persecuted people and so on. Well, these were the kind of associations that came to my mind out of the... And then very often, well, suffering was something rather sentimental, even. I felt lonely, and that's a great suffering. Well, it is a suffering. I don't want to deny that, but nevertheless, it was kind of striking as a contrast. Only sometimes was usually kind of thinking of really more concrete and suffering that would put at stake the very survival of people. And sometimes the sufferings I was listening about were really tiny sufferings compared to that. But of course, it is correct, and in counseling and so on, you also have to bring up that reality of personal suffering, sickness, grief, and all of that. That's very, very legitimate. But if it's confined only to those areas, probably it becomes a little bit cheap suffering, I suspect. Yes?
The new poor in this country are single-parent females. In fact, the largest growing poor population in this country are single-parent females. And as I mix with some close female friends of mine who are feminists, I find them leaving the traditional church of any denomination. I wonder if you can talk to them.
Well, try to be very brief. I think if that's the case, and you probably are right, as much as I can feel you are right, these are among the least ones in your midst. And Jesus wants to be on their side, and is calling the his followers also to be on the side of these people. So I think that's a kind of a process that should be going on. Who are the least ones among us? And that's where Jesus is already present, and we should be following him.
Is the term liberation theology one that should be applied to the Latin American experience just because of its unique history and time, or to the process that can be applied to other cultures?
Well, I imagine that it is, first place, it is out of Latin America, and of course a kind of transplant from there into the United States, Europe, or even Africa or Asia won't work, and should not be attempted, I think, a direct transplant. But that does not mean that there cannot be some elements which in a new context will then bring fruit in a different way. So I do think that that kind of thrust of which in Latin America was perceived of Jesus moving towards the least ones, I'm very much convinced that's very evangelical. That's very much in the heart of the Gospels. And so that kind of movement probably should be listened and pursued in other places too, towards different people possibly, in different ways, but I think that that kind of passion for the least ones, that is the most important element, whatever form it then takes. Possibly some of the methodological approaches of liberation theology can be used too. I mentioned the other day, Bible studies like to see our reality.